If you've ever run a marathon over the past 30 years, the odds are very good that Jim Davis was there to take your picture. You see, Jim has taken more pictures at more races than any other photographer in the world. In fact, Jim invented the concept of race photography that is now standard at every major marathon across the globe. He founded Marathon Photo in his dorm room at the University of Kansas in the 70s, despite his dad telling him that photography was a terrible career to pursue. There's actually much more to Jim than being the guy who enables our humble bragging on Instagram. Jim is a successful entrepreneur and a true artist who has published books and exhibited his fine art photos in countless galleries. His photography career has taken him not only to marathons around the world, but also to a dawn photo shoot at the Taj Mahal in India. That was special for Jim because he has long drawn upon his meditation practice to inform his work and home life. Much of his meditation training has roots in India, and it served him well at the 2013 Boston Marathon, where he was one of the closest photographers to the first bomb that detonated near the finish line. Jim describes how he was able to handle the crisis calmly and how much it meant to him to capture the comeback stories of the 2014 Boston Marathon, where many runners paid tribute to the previous year's tragedy. If you like stories about true innovators and real Renaissance men, you'll love our visit with Jim. He even offers a few tips for making you look good in your next set of race photos. Let's dive in.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Our for listeners who are tuning in, hoping to hear the founder and CEO of New Balance shoes, they may be a little disappointed, but we think your career is even more interesting to most of our listeners who are avid endurance athletes and marathon runners. And so you've had such an amazing career since 1974 in building the largest event photography company in the world. And I think probably personally, you've probably taken more pictures of runners than any other human on earth. Is that a fair guess?
I would guess so. And if for no other reason that I've just been at it so long. You know, there's a lot of the marathon photo photographers who photograph a lot of people, but, you know, I've been doing this thing for getting close to 50 years now, 45 years. So it's, yeah, it adds up, but, and I tend to shoot volume too. So what can I say? I love doing it. That's the crazy thing. It's just fun to do.
It's a little bit addictive. I sort of compare it to it's like playing cards. You know, you could have a bad hand of cards, but then the next hand comes up, you got a fresh start. Or golf, right? You could screw up hole two, but here comes hole three, fresh start.
That's right. So, it's true.
That's great of you to make time for us. And so I'd love to maybe dive into your background eventually and get a little bit. I think the early days story is fascinating to me, but. To start off, I'd love to hear what your advice is to runners. I think, you know, we've often said that that race photographs are, if it's not the most popular piece of digital media out there in the world, I'm not sure what is. I mean, this is a picture of you doing something at a moment of personal accomplishment. It means a lot to people. It's a joyous and happy occasion when someone crosses the finish line of a New York Marathon or Chicago Marathon or London, which you photograph them all. But what are your main pieces of advice for runners to improve the quality of their images? How can they ensure that they get a better lifetime memory out of the photo experience?
We're at lots of places along the course. So the chances of you having a good picture and several of them are really high. So I don't think you have to do anything really in particular that's special, but when you get close to the finish line, we usually pack it the right before and right on the finish line. And people are usually celebrating at that point. The only thing I would say there is that as you get towards the finish line, if the space allows, run towards the outside. Because if you're in the middle, we'll only get you from the photo bridge, and we will. But if you're on the outside, we can get you with your fist pumping and the excitement on your face. And that's really, that's the money shot as far as I'm concerned. You know, the excitement of being at the finish line, because all of the motion that you build up of the months of training and then the actual day of race itself, you know, it all comes out at the finish line. And I don't care how many times people have been through marathons. I mean, I know people who have run many, many times, and they'll all say that the finish line every time is just an emotional experience. So that's what we want to capture the most, is that emotion at the finish line.
That's great. And talk to us about that. So you've been at the finish line of world major marathons probably hundreds of times now at this point in your career. What are some of those stories that really stick out in your mind of some of those emotional stories, people coming across the line?
You know, there's so many of them. I mean, you know, why do I keep coming back after half a century of doing this? Because the emotion and the excitement, and there's an emotion and an excitement in the event itself, but then the connection of knowing that you're there to witness this important moment with these runners. I mean, it's a split second that we have with each runner, but just to see the expression on the face, it's there's no better high out there. You know, there's just something wonderful and magical about it. And it's an honor to be a part of it. I'll give two stories.
Great.
I mean, and there's hundreds, thousands more, but this is 2014 at the Boston Marathon. This is the year after the tragedy at Boston. And I knew almost immediately when we knew what had happened at Boston, and I was right by the finish line, actually, where on the outside where it happened, and one of the other photographers was directly across from the first bomb. And because, you know, I knew that the next year that there were going to be people who had been injured who would run.
Right.
Because that's just what runners do, and that's what makes runners. People who were spectators, who were not participants, because of that tragedy, knew that they had to be a participant the next year. And there was a photographer for Sports Illustrated who actually spent a year with those people in recovery. You know, you talked, and, you know, being fitted with prosthetics and the whole thing. And I talked to him the next year, 2014, I said, how was your year? And he said, it was the worst year of my life, but it was probably the most meaningful, because he was charting the course of those people recovering. So there were many, many people in 2014 who ran with prosthetics, and some of them had aid. And because of where I was positioned, which was right in front of the announcing stand, which was not at all far from the marathon shoe store.
Right.
Where that was, about 10 feet from where I was photographing, there was a makeshift memorial to the runners from the previous year. And runners during the day would see that and come over. And most of them knelt and offered a prayer. And that was about as touching and moving as it can get. And then towards the end of the day, there was an older couple from Japan. And one of them had a Japanese flag and the other had an American flag. And they came over and bowed at the memorial. And that was really touching. You know, they came from halfway around the world to run Boston, but specifically to offer their, you know, their condolences at that memorial. And it was not a formal thing. It was the people in Boston had set it up, and there were shoes there. So I'll give you three. There was another guy that came over, and he took his shoes off and left them there, and then he finished in his bare feet.
Wow.
And the last one was a man who was running on two prosthetic legs. And he had a guide with him to help him keep his balance. But he, you know, he was pretty much on his own. And he came over. And he was not, of course, able to kneel. But he bent over. And he spent a long time. And then he turned and he finished. And I looked for the picture afterwards, because, you know, this is happening in the moment. And then you have to go back and photograph the other runners. But because I was right there with that, I needed to capture those people with that memorial. And I looked at the picture, and on the back of his jersey, it said MR8, which stood for Martin Richardson, 8 years old.
Right.
Or I guess it was Martin Richards.
Yes.
The young boy. It was a charity that was running on in his memory. So here's a guy who himself was part of that experience, but he was over to offer his prayers to Martin, that young boy.
I'd never heard that story. So, and that was not, it wasn't something runners were alerted to ahead of time. This was just an impromptu memorial, and runners would spot this as they were coming down the down Boylston Street. And they
there was nothing announced. They would just see it as they came down Boylston. If you were on the north side of Boylston, which was just on the other side of the fence from where the first bomb was placed. So it was just impromptu. It was there. And, but it was, you know, you could see it because if you were on that side of the road. And actually that guy, of course, he must have known, because he came, the guy on the two prosthetics came pretty much down the middle of the road. But all, he was also much later in the race, so he could see the whole field. So it wouldn't be anybody was blocking him.
Got it.
So maybe he just looked over and saw it, but you know, he came over and the guide, you know, helped balance him, and they spent a good amount of time there.
So what was your, I've never asked you this, but what was your reaction back in 2013? What did you do when that first bomb went off?
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you some detail, because it's instructive in some ways, but the first thought that, I mean, and I've looked at the pictures, I remember it was a sunny day. It was a warm spring day. It was a beautiful day. It was a perfect day. And then the first bomb went off, and I thought, ooh, that's not good.
But you knew that was not a car backfiring or something. You knew this was something wrong.
No, but my mind to process it, it was kind of wild, because I've been at the start, and Brad can attest to this many times, at the Marine Corps Marathon, and they start the race with the howitzer going on.
Right.
And this sounded like the howitzer. It was not a normal, you know, firework or something like that. So, or it wasn't a car backfiring. But my first thought that it must have been a gas explosion in one of the buildings, because I never would have thought that there would be a bomb in Boston. Right. Never. But I immediately processed and knew it wasn't good. And I thought, well, there's nothing I can do. My role is to keep photographing. There are plenty of emergency people here, and they'll be taking care of whatever needs to be done. So I kept taking photos. And then the second one went off, and then I knew this is something we weren't expecting.
So you stayed in your position after that first one went off.
Oh yeah,
and continued to photograph runners coming down Boylston Street.
Correct, because they were still coming. They didn't really know what had happened either. You know,
I see. Oh, I thought there was about 15 seconds, and then they shut the whole street down. So.
Well, and this is what's instructive. So, as soon as the second one went off, I thought, this is an attack of some kind. Mm. There may be more. And I was going to, I had my cameras beside me in a case, and I was going to pick them up and take them. But they were sitting on top of the backpack, not in it. And I thought, I don't have time to put them inside. And I, what went through my mind, and this was, you know, I had heard this story just a few years before, an old friend from when I was young, suburbs of Chicago, and somebody said, well, whatever happened to David? And David had been living in San Francisco. And when there was the earthquake, his apartment caught on fire. And he got out, and after he got out, he remembered he'd left his guitar inside. And he went back for the guitar and never came out.
Oh, man.
And I thought, and so the thought that went through my mind, I mean, immediately remembered David and said, forget the cameras. They're staying here. And I thought, I need to leave. And I left them there, and I thought, if there's a chance, we'll go back later and get them, time to leave. Immediately went behind the finish line because the second one was in front. Even further in front, and I figured that they weren't behind, that they were in front, whatever it was that was going on. And I mentioned that because of the thought process involved. It took me almost a minute to tell you that. I was on videotape. All the TV cameras up above were filming this. And I've seen myself many times. There was no hesitation. I had the camera in my hand. The second you can hear the second one go off, I immediately turn and leave. That whole process of thinking was instantaneous. There was, you know, so time had changed in that moment. Things were condensed. Things were in a different space. I thought I was thinking clearly, but not the way I usually think. And that's all I can say. I had been practicing transcendental meditation for many years. And I think because of that, I probably maintained a little bit more calmness spontaneously than if I had not. It's a way to settle down and get deep relaxation when you practice it. But after you've been doing it a long time, it just sort of carries over into daily life. So when I was behind the finish line, I ran into Darren Lazarus, who was the other photographer on the directly across the street, because he was directly across, he had felt the impact. And I hadn't, because I was at a diagonal from it. We were there together, and both glad to see each other and not harmed. We each took a few photos.
You mentioned you tried to shoot a few photos once you left your position, were in a safe spot. At that point, did your instincts say, hey, I'm a photojournalist at this point and I should try to capture some shots?
We both did that. And then, you know, Darren mentioned it first, but I agreed with him. You know, he said, hey, you know, maybe we should go up and see what's going on the photo bridge and help the guys with equipment. And I said, you know, you're right, because, you know, I thought that our crew would be taking care of everything. And I said, you know, we're not photojournalists. What are we doing with this stuff?
Right.
And the, I then went back and got the camera bag and the rest of the cameras, because I knew at that point a minute or two, a couple of minutes in probably now. And I feared that there weren't any more bombs going off. That was probably the end of it, hopefully. And I figured if I leave the camera bag there, I'll never see it again. So I got that bag, and we went up above, and believe it or not, there was only one guy left, Kyle Dick, who was the manager for the photo bridge. So it was really good that Darren and I went up, because he was personally putting all the cameras. I mean, we had cameras like you would believe, and tripods and all that, and clamps that, and he was putting them all in the cases, and he wouldn't have been able to get them down by himself. So he was just finishing it up, because as soon as the bombs went off, everybody else left. They were down and they were out of there. Well, probably made good sense, but he stayed with the position. So
You guys are braver than I am. I think I would have been sprinting down Boston Street the other way, but
who knows?
Your business instincts, meditation practice kicked in, and
yeah. It just seemed like that's what we should be doing. And then, so we were finishing this stuff, and I was starting to carry one case down, and a policeman then at this point was coming up the steps, and he said, "Get out of here, leave everything." And I said, "No, we're not." He said, "Just leave the stuff, get down off this place." And I said, "Officer, you want this place to be clean. We're cleaning it for you. We're taking it down. It's ready to go. Just let us get down the steps." And he's moved aside, and we moved all our equipment off. I mean, the timing couldn't have been better. I mean, for getting it off. And we got everything down and out of there. We never would have seen all those cameras again, because they would have all been in some place in Quantico, Virginia.
Right. That's right. 12 years from now, you'd get it.
12 years from now. What is this
letter?
Yeah. Who knows? So we got it all down, and then we got to the back, and there was a meeting place a block and a half away where the cars had been parked. And it was turned out to be totally safe. And we knew that if we didn't get out of there pretty soon, that everything was starting to get locked down because they needed to do the FBI clearance and everything, which FBI was already there, not just Homeland Security. They had people on site before the race started. So they were going to work. So one of our ladies didn't want to leave. She was behind the finish line because she couldn't account for all of her people. And we told her, she's, you know, like the guys in the photo bridge said, "Look, they went home. They left. You're not going to find them. You know, we've got to leave." So we convinced her and we all left and we got back to the hotel. And at which point Darren and I actually deleted some of the images that we had taken.
You did.
And we saved a few, but the ones that were most gruesome, we deleted because we said, this is not what Marathon Photo does. We show moments of achievement and accomplishment. Those photojournalists would never delete something like that, but that's not what we were there to do.
Yeah.
And so you asked about that. So, you know, fortunately, Darren said we should get up and help out with equipment, and we got there just in time to get it on.
Now, how about on a happier note? You've probably seen lots of finish line wedding proposals, or, you know, sometimes you'll see someone do a cartwheel over the finish line or get down and kiss the ground. You've probably seen your fair share of quirky
things. Lots of people jump and click their heels. They do cartwheels. Some will stop and do push-ups. A lot of the veterans, when you get to Marine Corps, other races, but you can tell the veterans, they'll do 22 push-ups for the number of people with PTSD who don't make it. It's a thing.
22.
Without going into that. But wedding proposals, my best one. This was at the marathon in New Orleans, and it finishes in the park. It's a beautiful park. And and I tell you this because it was so ingenious how the guy did it. It's a park and it's a smaller marathon, so that the crowd is sort of right there and there's a fence and all that. Anyway, this guy is running in, and he's about 50 feet from the finish line, and he grabs his leg and falls down, and, you know, in pain
before the finish line.
Pardon me?
Before he reached the finish line.
Just before he reached the finish line, you know. And immediately this lady jumps over the fence and runs over to help him out. And he gets up on his knee and proposes to her right there inside the finish line. And then I immediately ran, out in front and got pictures of them, because she's still with him and he's still on his knee. And I made sure I got pictures of the numbers so we'd know who the couple was. And proposals are always happy. I've seen a lot of them.
Yeah.
The one where they do it the most is in Las Vegas. They would count, and usually there would be 5, 6, 7 proposals in Las Vegas. I guess it's because they could get married right away then too.
They could propose at the race and then later that night have go right to the chapel on the strip.
Go straight to the chapel. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Let's take a minute to acknowledge one of our sponsors, Marathon Photo, capturing proud runners and creating happy customers for over 35 years. 8 million runners have trusted Marathon Photo to capture and deliver the best in race and endurance event photography. Whether your race is in person or virtual, we will be there to capture your glory. Visit www.marathonphoto.com to check out our photo archives and learn more about our virtual experiences.
Rewinding a bit. So how did you, I'm always fascinated by entrepreneurial stories and how companies got started. So I know a little bit about the founding of Marathon Photo, but would love to hear in your words what your thought was coming right out of undergraduate and right out of college at the University of Kansas and how you started this business originally.
Well, I'm gonna reel back to high school.
Right.
And it's instructive. And you said entrepreneurial mind and all that. So this will give you an idea on how an entrepreneurial mind puts things together. So I went, I ended up going to a very large high school, suburbs of Chicago. And beginning of my freshman year, my dad pulled me aside. And he says, you know, you're interested in sports, but this school is so big, you're not going to make it in basketball or baseball. Your athletic career is pretty much over. Unless, he said, I know that the cross country team is looking for some people to run. And I said, what's that? Because I'd never heard of it. And he says, well, it's running, and it's distance running. And I said, I'm not that fast. And he said, well, that's the thing. You don't have to be fast. It's endurance. You just have to stick it out. And they need some people on the team. Why don't you try out? So I did, and I made the cross country team. Now, the other thing I remember just recently, in fact, I shared it with Catherine Switzer and her husband, Roger, that about a month after into the season, we had a session in gym class. It was on wrestling. Now, I had always wanted to be a wrestler. I got my folks to buy me wrestling mats so I could wrestle with my friends in grade school and all. And we did this, we did the thing, and they taught you, you know, the basic stuff for wrestling. And afterwards, one of the gym instructors, who also was the wrestling coach, pulled me aside and he says, I think you could make the team. You want to try out? And I said, yeah, what's involved? He says, well, starting the end of this week, you got to be in the weight room. And I said, but I'm on the cross country team. And he says, well, you got to choose. I stuck with cross country. I, even though I'd always wanted to be a wrestler, I thought, wow, this is, you know, I was into the running now and I wanted to see the season through. So
if the wrestling coach had been more persuasive, millions of people would not have their marathon finish line photos, right?
Thank you for your observation, David. Cause it's like, you know, it's a little thing in high school. Who would have ever thought? But it was like, you know, it was a split second decision. I thought, I'm liking running. I'm going to stick with this sport.
I love it. I think in physics, there's a concept of the butterfly effect, right? Where a butterfly flaps its wings in Asia, and that can have repercussions across the entire globe, potentially, if they flap their wings at just the right moment or just the right atmospheric conditions.
I've had that thought. You're right. There are lots of stories in running with the butterfly effect of somebody did a little thing and it has its effects somewhere else. But so in that moment, I stuck with running. I got to college, the University of Kansas. I thought, you know, nobody recruited me to be on the cross country team. I didn't really think too much about it. And then I thought, well, maybe I should at least ask somebody. And fortunately, I didn't go to the coach, but I don't know who I talked to, but somebody who knew. He said, you know who's on the cross country team? I said, no. He said, no, Jim Ryan? Well, Jim Ryan was the first high school kid to run under 4 minutes in the mile.
He said,
he's on the cross country team. And he said, you want to know something else? There's a whole bunch of other guys who are almost as fast as he is. I never showed up at the coach's
good
office.
Luck. Right.
That was the end of it. So I didn't run in college then. So fast forward, I was teaching some classes in between. I'll tell you the story of how I got into photography really quick into that.
I'd love to hear it. Yeah.
So I'm now at the University of Kansas. I'm from Chicago. I don't know people because there were about 10 kids from my class. And one of my best friends from childhood went there, but most, you know, most of the people we didn't know. So I thought I needed to join a fraternity and make some friends. So I joined a fraternity. It was not one of the most socially well-respected fraternities.
Let's say.
It wasn't as bad as Animal House, but it got pretty close to it, if you know the movie.
A few misfits, all right.
But it was an interesting mix of guys. Let's put it that way. But the guy who owned the franchise for campus photography, for parties, the party pick guy, he was in my fraternity. So I didn't know that, but about 2 weeks into school, he pulls me aside. I had gotten a camera when I was in, for my 16th birthday, a friend of the family, my folks were teachers. And one of the other teachers at the high school got a new camera, and she used to take trips, and she'd taken trips with us. And she was, you know, was the documentary person with the camera. And she gave me her old camera for my 16th birthday. So I really was into doing photos, and I get to this university and I, you know, take pictures around campus. And this guy had seen me, and he said, "So you like taking pictures, don't you?" And I said, "Well, yeah." He says, "So what are you doing on Saturday night?" So, you know, you got to bluff the guy, you're in the fraternity. And I said, "Well, you know, the usual, I'm going to have a date."
Hot date, you know, sure.
Hot date. Yeah, and we're going out for dinner, and then we'll go see a show, you know, and whatever afterwards, right? And he says, "No, you're not. You haven't had a date yet." And I said, "Well, but maybe this weekend." He said, "No, you're not." So then he's got my number. What am I going to do? He says, "So how would you like to go to a party, meet girls, take pictures, and get paid to do it?" And I said, "What's the catch?" He said, "No, it's no catch. It's a business." He said, "I own the business." He said, "I need another photographer for Saturday night. I've got the camera here. This is a different one than you've got." He showed me how to use the thing. He said, "I'll pay you to do this thing. You meet girls, and you'll get a social life." And that was. I made my spending money all through college doing that. So fast forward, I'm now doing my master's thesis in education. I had taught school for a year. That's another story some other time.
Okay. The family tradition of educators.
Yeah, family tradition of educators. So it took me a long time to finish my thesis. So I started a party pick business on the side, because I needed some money. It was taking too long. And when I finished the master's thesis, I had a business, you know, never went back to education again. And I thought, well, you know, if the business doesn't make it, I've got a profession. But that was it kept going. And first thing that came along was photographing graduations. And that was the breakthrough on that was, and this was a lab that sent me this thing of how to make money photographing graduations. Well, they didn't tell you how to do it. They just told you how to convince an administrator that you could do it. So, but the idea was, is that, and they had gotten this from some guy in Texas named Smiley. And Smiley would show up at graduations and he'd take pictures, and he would put a little passport size proof on an order form and mail it to people. And he had figured out
to the parents of the graduate.
The parents of the graduates. Now, in those days, you didn't even really have to have permission from the school, because every high school published a directory that gave everybody's home address. So he would just pick up one of those and he would mail them out. And he figured out that enough people would order these things that he could pay for the postage and the processing and the little proof, and he would make money on the deal because they would send back the order form and all of that. So that was, they said, do this in graduation. So I was doing it in Chicago, and but it was seasonal and the parties were seasonal. Once you got through with rush at the beginning of the fall, there wasn't much going on until the next spring. So I was doing a part-time thing in Cleveland, and there was this article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and it said that they were going to have a marathon. They expected 15,000 runners and 100,000 spectators. And immediately the light bulb went off in my head, because when I ran, nobody else wanted to run. The only reason I was on the team, I was not a good runner. I was not one of the fast guys. I was there because they needed to fill spots because there was nobody running.
Right.
And all of a sudden, there's thousands of people running and thousands of spectators. And I thought,
oh, this is the 70s running boom and Jim Fix and all
this
that.
This was 1977. It had just started a couple years before, and I hadn't noticed it. Nobody ever watched a cross-country meet. Even the family never came and watched. The fact that people would show up to watch people run, I thought, this is a social movement. Something has changed. And I would bet that these people, after all of their training, are going to want to buy a picture. So I tried the same thing out. It wasn't until a year later because that race was coming up immediately. But I figured people would probably buy pictures.
Was anyone else doing this? Were there any other companies? No. Okay.
No, I found out a year, years later, there was a guy in Canada who did something at almost the same time, but he only did he was actually a cross country ski racer.
Oh.
He was doing a cross country ski event in Europe, and somebody took his picture. And he said, can I have a copy of that? And the guy says, well, let me see your number. And he said, I can find out who you are that way, you know. But he only did a few small races in Canada until we started doing it in a big fashion in the States. And then when we were trying to book some races in Canada, he started doing more of them as well. He wasn't just doing cross country events ski events he was doing. Then he decided, well, I can do running events too. But in terms of the running, no, I was the first guy. And it was only because, as I said, I'd had that experience in high school and I thought there might be an interest here.
So what was the first race that you photographed?
First one was the Chicago Distance Classic. Hmm. And that was in the summer. And the Distance Classic, I think, was like 20 kilometers or something like that. It was almost a half marathon. Not a full marathon.
Okay.
Now that one was, and the reason for that is that most of the races didn't have, they didn't have a database because computers were in the 70s were like, you know, you had not profit organizations or small people doing running events didn't have databases.
Sure.
And, but the Chicago Distance Classic was run by the Chicago Lung Association. It was a charitable event. People were, the money that they paid to run the thing would go to make money for the Lung Association. And they had made some appearance arrangement with Frank Shorter, who was the gold medalist in the marathon at the time. And so there was some publicity and hype about it. And I had talked to a guy who was my salesman. The business was big enough at that point. There was a guy who was out trying to get new accounts for me. Well, he happened to have a relative who worked for the Lung Association who knew that they could actually produce mailing labels. And so that was the key to that event. So now there was a lot to be learned. In fact, that event was pretty much a bust because it was a wide street. Brad can attest, this is where the marathon actually finishes, in Grant Park. It's a wide street. We had 50 millimeter lenses. Well, the runners were minuscule, you know, and you couldn't read their numbers because, you know, and I was trying to get into the street as far as I could. The other guys were on the outside and I was kept, you know, getting further in to get closer to them. We had our little caps that they gave us in a t-shirt that showed that we were supposed to be race officials. And I didn't pay much attention, but I noticed that there was this mounted policeman coming down the street and he was getting the crowd back and all of that. And I kept taking pictures and all of that. And he comes up to me and says, get out of here. And I said, I'm official. I got this, you know, see the hat and all of that. Yeah. He picked me up by my shirt. And, you know, he's on the horse, so he's way up there, and I'm down on the ground. Picks me up by the shirt, throws me off towards the side of the curb, and, you know, I you know, made sure that I didn't drop the camera at this point. And then he, you know, didn't get hurt either. And he turns around and says, "You get back on that in the road and you're going to jail." And, and Chicago's finest at work right there. And so after, you know, he kept going and I was a fair ways in front of the finish line. He went behind the finish line, never saw him again. And after about 10 minutes, my heart rate had gotten back to close to normal and my blood pressure was probably close to normal. And I thought, well, let's give it a shot again. Maybe he won't come back. And he never did. I shot the rest of the race, but it was not a large percentage of pictures that were worth anything.
So, but you were able to print out the thumbnails and mail them out to these mailing lists, these mailing labels that you got. So some people nibbled. So it sounds like it was enough encouragement to think maybe there is a business here, but our execution wasn't too hot in this first race.
Exactly. It was like, okay, we can fine tune this thing and make something out of it. And at that point, it was novel enough that, you know, people were interested. It wasn't quite like graduations because you could run a few events in a year and you'd graduate once every four or five or however many years, right?
Right.
But you make up for it in numbers, you know, when you have thousands of people running an event.
Yeah, if only 5% buy, yeah.
Yeah. So the percentage was actually even higher than most
of them
initially. So yeah, it paid for the postage to send them out and then I got this, there were a couple of magazines out at the time. Well, actually there were three. There was Running Times, The Runner, and Runner's World. And eventually they all got folded into Runner's World. That's the premier one now. But Running Times used to have the best calendars for smaller events.
They were sort of the real runners running magazine back then.
You remember, well, yeah.
I'm an old man too, yeah.
Not that old, but they were the runners. Yeah. And so I was looking through there and everything in the Midwest, we didn't go very far, but in the Midwest. And so there were a lot of events and nobody else was doing it. So I could call up the race director. They tell you how to, you know, the guy would answer the phone and say, "Hey, can I take pictures? And can I get the list of the addresses?" And some of them would say, "Gee, I don't." There was, there was one really big one that we finally booked. This was in San Diego, and this was the fall of 78. And that was marathon and 10K. Mm. And we got the thing booked, but I didn't realize they said they were going to have a database, but they didn't. Ooh. They had all of these paper things. And so we actually had to hire temp workers to go in and hand write about 10,000 addresses on proof cards.
Wow.
And when it was all said and done, it was barely a break even because it took a month to get the pictures out. And that was crazy. So for a long time, we actually had in our contracts that, you know, we would give so much per address label, but we would quit paying the money if we didn't get them after a certain period of time. If we didn't get them within 3 weeks or 4 weeks, whatever it was, that they wouldn't get paid. But anyway, because there were, what would happen, and there was one guy in particular, every year he'd say, "Yeah, I'll get it for you next week." The day after the race, he'd take a month vacation.
Oh, man.
It'd be a month before we'd ever see those addresses. We'd get them, but by then the runners were not interested as much. So.
But I mean, you're being modest, but this it eventually became a very successful and lucrative business. But at what point did you feel as if, hey, there really is something here? This is not just a crazy idea. I can really make a nice living out of this.
Pretty early on, we got enough big events that so there was decent money. But I guess, you know, to, more to your point, David, to know when was this really catching on? This was in the early 80s. One of the events we had was the Rocket City Marathon in Huntsville, Alabama. Huntsville, Alabama has a NASA headquarters, which is why it's called the Rocket City. It was a nice little event. It wasn't one of the biggest marathons, but it was at the end of the season, either the end last week of November or first week of December. So after all of the other fall marathons, it was far enough south that they could still have one. And, you know, you fly out the day after the event, and I was on the plane, and there were half the plane was full of runners, you know. So I was chatting with the guys in the seats next to me, how the race was. We were just talking shop and everything. And they said, so how, they, one of them asked me, so how was your race? I said, well, actually, I wasn't running. I was a marathon photo, took the pictures. They said, oh, we can't wait to get the marathon photos in the mail. And now I knew at that point we had copiers, you know, there were other people photographing, and if, you know, they may not have been our pictures.
Sure.
But the fact that they didn't say the pictures, they said the marathon photos, and because they knew the name of our company. And I thought, this is like Kleenex. It's not facial tissue anymore. It's Kleenex. And I thought, we are a brand name.
Yes.
And then I knew that we had made it. And, you know, we at some point we were doing, this is even by the early 80s, we're doing like over 100 events a year. And it took until 83 to get Chicago and Boston. It took the larger ones time to convince them to what we were doing. I still have, in fact, I was going through some a drawer last week, and I ran across my 1983 credentials from the Chicago Marathon. And so there's a lot of fun memories in all of that.
And most entrepreneurs have a near-death experience kind of story at some point along the line. Were there points where you were growing quickly or had a terrible day at a major marathon or something with rain or photographers didn't show up, but were there ever any white knuckle kind of rides along the way?
I thought we were going to keep this on a high note, David.
No. We're putting you on the psychologist couch here. We want to know your deep secrets.
There were lots of them. I mean, well, you know, I kidded Brad, and this may have even been before his time. I don't know. But there was one Chicago marathon when it was snowing, and it was
October.
It was October, and they used to do it the last weekend in October. Well, that was not a good time for Chicago, and they had an early snowfall. It was, I think the high was maybe 35 or 36.
Man.
And it was along the lakefront, right? They ran along Lakeshore Drive, and the wind is blowing in off the lake, and it's creating snow. I mean, it's not just little bits of snowing. It was like slush on the roads, and we're wondering if you know, will the runners buy these things? Can we, I mean, it was hard. This is all film.
Sure.
So we were, you know, we had people who would load the cameras. Well, their fingers are stiff. They couldn't get the film in and out of the cameras fast enough. So you're missing runners' pictures because you just don't have a camera ready to take pictures. We had another one in February called the Loop the Loop, Mayor Byrne. She was an interesting mayor in Chicago.
Yeah.
And she had this early season. It was right around Valentine's Day. Why she would do it then, but you know, instead of giving out little hats or t-shirts, they gave out knit caps because it would be cold.
Sure.
Well, it was so cold one year that the film was literally breaking inside the cameras. It was like 15 degrees. I mean, that was like a total
wipeout.
You just couldn't shoot pictures. Fortunately, there were enough other events that, you know, you lose a bunch of money on this one. It didn't kill you. We've had events where did we have the credentials to get to where we needed? No. And how are we going to take the pictures? I don't know. You know, there was one where we were expecting, I mean, this is commonplace now, but this was the first time. This was in Atlanta and the hurricane was coming. And we're watching the weather. We got down there 2 or 3 days early to try to get everything set up. And we had lift trucks, you know, booms that would go out over the road because it was wide enough that you couldn't shoot from just the side of the road. And we bought wood and plastic sheeting and we created shelters in these boom trucks. Hopefully there would be no lighting, so that even if it rained, we could still take pictures. And, you know, so that was the first time we ever had to do that. We were
concerned. But it worked?
It worked.
Yeah.
It only was drizzling when we were shooting, so it kept us dry enough to shoot the race. But literally, as we got back to the hotel to, you know, put all of the equipment and the film and everything together, it opened up and it poured and poured and poured. And we were lucky later to be able to get planes out. They, you know, they were delaying flights because the winds and all that. I mean, it was serious. So we fortunately, the race got over just before the worst of the storm came in.
And I think most people have a rough idea of what happens today with digital photography, right? You have New York Marathon, you have 100 photographers out there taking pictures on digital cameras, upload those to the cloud. People in India go in and type in the bib numbers and tag those photos. And
yeah,
I think most people have a rough idea of how that happens. But explain how this happened in the old film days. That seems almost impossible logistically to me to think back to that. But how did you pull that off to take pictures of 50,000 people in a race using film?
Well, as I said, that we had loaders. And at a race, you would have, you know, at the larger ones, small ones, you could get by with one loader. But usually at the major races, Boston, New York, Chicago, whatever, you would have two. And
two per photographer.
Two per photographer. They could... the good ones could load a roll of film in about 30 to 40 seconds. But you would often shoot, there's 36 pictures. So that's one a second. You could shoot more than one a second. So literally you needed to have two and the extra cameras. Now the cameras had motor drives on them. I remember the first race we had, it was in Detroit. We didn't have motor drives. By the end of the race, every camera except for the last one, we had broken off the film advance lever because you were doing it so fast, they finally just broke.
Broke, right.
We had like 10 cameras all down. And afterwards, I talked to my partner and I said, you know, what is going to cost us to repair these cameras? We could have bought a motor drive for each of these darn things and we wouldn't have lost runner's pictures.
Probably.
So that was that.
There's probably thumb blood on there too at some point.
It wasn't that
blistered
bad.
Thumbs, day. But yeah.
It wasn't that bad, David, but it was close to it. But
we would have two
per photographer and we would have just bags of film. And one of the white knuckle experiences with Chicago Marathon. I was on the scaffold at the finish line and we were running out of film. They had more runners than they told us that we're going to have. And we were running out of film. And I told them, I said, don't take any extras. Make sure you got one money shot of each runner.
Right.
Sometimes you would take two, you know, cause you could, and maybe the number's covered up once and then you get one without the number being covered. And and I went into the hotel and they had 24 exposure film and it was ridiculously expensive. And I pulled out the credit card and bought, you know, it was towards the end of the race. I bought an extra 20 rolls of film to get us through to the end. But man. So we would get all these rolls of film in bags and then, you know, we would sort them by position so that we would keep each position the same.
Was each roll of film marked with a Sharpie or something?
It didn't have to be.
Okay.
Because it was all by the number, but you just have each position marked. So we keep each position. And then we would have one, and they would all go into this giant box. And we had one guy who was always the designated driver to take them to the airport. And there was the Postal Service had express mail delivery. And you could take it there, and depending on the city, you get it there before 10 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night, depending on the city. And they would have a flight that would go to wherever, and you would pay extra, of course, but it would arrive in Oklahoma City where our lab was. And there was really, at the time, only one lab in the entire country that would make these passport-sized proofs from long rolls of film. They would actually... take the rolls of film, 36 exposure, splice them together and make them like movie reels. So they would come out on these large reels with, you know, hundreds or thousands of images on each reel. And they had machines set up so that they could then load them up and run them through and make prints. And, you know, they're, almost every other lab was using cut strips of negatives because other photographers were shooting weddings and portraits, and they weren't shooting tens of thousands of images at a time. So there's one lab, Oklahoma City, and we had to get it there overnight. And in the morning, they would, you know, they would know that the film was coming in, and they would have somebody go to the airport and pick up the film, and they would start processing. And then they would make the proofs, and a day or two later, it would all come back, and we'd go to the airport and pick the stuff up. And then it was all, each of these were on long strips of contact proofs. And we would physically cut them with scissors, paste them onto an order form, and then other people would look at them with a magnifying glass and ID the number and write the number in pen on that order form. And then after they were all identified individually, then we would sort them. You know, you'd sort them by thousands, then hundreds, then tens. And then you would get them down, and then you would staple each person's pictures together. And because it was film, you couldn't shoot like you do with digital. So most people got three or four pictures.
I see.
And some would only get one, and a few would be lucky and get four. But it was all done by hand. And it was all the same people. The same people who had been shooting on the weekend, now they're all IDing 2 days later.
Oh, those same photographers would come in.
Most of them were. They all were in-house.
And loops and
staplers. And then, you know, later we had to get more and more photographers and specialized, just photographers and just people in the office. And, oh, we didn't have a mailing machine for the longest time. So we would actually have sponges and have to wet every envelope. And we had techniques for doing that. Finally, I mean, it took a while, but, you know, it took a while behind the technology curve. But where we were at the very front of the technology curve, 1996. And I remember this because our daughter was born in 95. A year later, one of the other guys in the company, he and his wife were expecting their first child. And he was telling us about, it was January, I think, too. It was like the very beginning of 96. And he said, you know, my wife has been connecting with other expectant mothers all over the country using this thing called the internet. And what's that? You know, tell us about it. And he said, it's the most amazing thing. And there were these expectant mothers, and they were communicating. And this was like really early on in the, you know, civilian use of the internet.
Right.
So with that, I said, I think we have a business opportunity here. And I went over to the guy who was in charge of, David, who was in charge of IT. And I said, heard about the internet? He said, yeah. How have you heard about it? He thought that only computer guys. Yeah. I says, well, you know, Rick's wife has been using it too. And he says, yeah. He says, well, what are you thinking? And I said, could we put an order form up on it? And he said, I don't know why. He says, hardly anybody knows about it. And I says, well, you know, some of the runners might know about it. They're pretty tech savvy.
Right,
like that.
Right.
So I said, but I mean, how difficult is this going to be? He says, well, if all we have is just a duplication of the order form, how many pictures you want, 5x7, 8x10, and your address, he said, it shouldn't take too many hours to do that. And I had to convince my partners. They said, we can't waste valuable programming time on this. And I said, well, talk to David. He says, it won't take that long. They said, so we gave it a try. We winged it. Sure enough, we got hundreds of orders. He said, how did these people find out about this? Who knows? But so we were like early adopters of the internet.
Very. So you're really one of the first e-commerce sites out there, certainly for photography.
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Hey, I want to shift gears for a second. You've been so generous with your time, but I've got 3 hours more questions for you, but we promise we won't take that much time. But part of your photography is taking you to some pretty interesting places, in addition to more marathons than probably any other human on earth. But I'd love to hear. I'm fascinated by your farm photography. You've published a beautiful book of black and white photography of farm threshing machines. But I'd love to hear where some of your personal, more artistic passions around photography have taken you.
Huh, interesting. What I've told people over the years is that I've been very fortunate that I've been able to use my craft to make enough of a living that I can afford my art. Because if I had to rely on doing art, fine art photography, we wouldn't have been having this conversation. But I mean, but the even better thing, David, is, you know, I've had two passions in life, running and photography. And to be able to make a living doing both, it's like, you couldn't have asked for anything more. So, I would go to great places. I have lots of travel photos that I've done. When we first went to London, we made sure that there were a few extra days in London. And every time I'm there, even if I only have a day, I make sure I get out with the camera and see some parts of London that I haven't seen before. Berlin was fantastic. And some of the experiences that I had around Germany, even close to Berlin, you know, to get outside the city. Great photos, great experiences of the people and all. Southern California, for the last several years, we would do the LA Marathon in March. Well, if you're from the Midwest or if you're from the Northeast or wherever, you know, Southern California, March, boy.
Yeah, better than home, yeah.
Yeah, so I would always make sure there was an extra several days after the race and go out into the Southern California desert. So I've got a pretty nice collection of desert photos. And you get up, and crazy thing is, you think you'd want to sleep extra, but if you want to get the sunrise, you better get up early. Yeah, and that's when the best light is. So.
You're being modest again, but you've presented at dozens and dozens of photography fine art shows. I realize that you may not be making millions of dollars off that, but your fine art photography is well respected and well received out there.
Well, thank you for the plug on that, Dave. I'll take it.
JimDavisImages.com. So.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to get a new fine art site. That sort of just gives you an idea of the breadth of what I've done over the years. And I am working with my daughter, who actually has a degree in photography, unlike me, who had my degree in education. But yeah, we're putting together a fine art photography thing. We're going to be launching it soon. We'll see how that works. But yeah, I've had several smaller museums. I had a weather photo that was included in the National Weather Service biennial a couple of years ago. That was kind of a cool thing.
Right.
I've had a lot of galleries that have taken the work on and both coasts as well as the Midwest. So it's kind of gratifying to have that. You mentioned the farm photos.
Love those.
Thank you. That was an amazing thing. I was doing graduate work at that point at the University of Kansas, and I saw this sticker on the back of a truck. It said threshing bee. And I thought, what the heck is that? And so I thought I better show up and figure it out. So I took along some film, and it was the most amazing thing. It was because it was mostly these people using steam implements. And somebody told me at the time that they had been using them until about 10 or 15 years before, even though they were made in the 20s and 30s for the most part, they kept using them until the 50s and 60s. So they would have this, you know, like an old fashioned, where a community thing, people would get together and they would harvest a field together. Well, it was more of just a social thing. It wasn't a practical thing of doing everyone, but they had a field and they would harvest it together, and they had music and entertainment, and people would go around and admire each other's machinery. And but in the process of taking those photos, I realized that this was a transition point in American farm life, that one time was passing and it would never be seen again. And it was shortly after that about 10 years after that, that you had this huge implosion of farms in the Midwest that people you know, many generations of farming had to leave the farm because they couldn't make a living at it anymore. So farming changed dramatically, and you know, I have a record of it. And I had somebody who haven't gotten around to it yet, but the George Eastman House Museum did a portfolio review, and he said, "You need to send this to the National Archive." He said, "I've never seen photos like this before," and I think that, you know, it's an, you know, a historic record. So I will get around to making a bunch of prints and sending them off.
Well, my favorite television show is American Pickers. Those guys would go to town on this. There's got to be a copy of your book on their checkout counter because they're based in Iowa, right? I think they started in Iowa.
Yeah. They're a little over, a couple hours from us, but yeah.
All right.
They're in Iowa.
That's your homework assignment. You've got to reach out to those guys and get your, maybe our podcast will launch your broadcast journalism career. And
thank you.
Artist on American Pickers. And I also know you mentioned your transcendental meditation, and some of your photographs from India are beautiful. And the Taj Mahal photos and the sunrise and the Taj Mahal and birds in flight in the foreground, really great stuff. But how is that, how's your meditation practice informed your business life and your personal life? You mentioned drawing on that at the Boston Marathon finish line in 2013, but how has that informed your business life and your outlook on the future?
Thank you for noticing those, David. And I'm going to answer two things, and I'm going to mention that particular photo, and it does tie into your main question of how does it inform my business life. But one of the things, one, people practice TM usually just to get deep rest, release stress, become more relaxed. It's a way to unwind. Now, a lot of runners use running for that same reason. You know, it gives them a chance to clear their head, they get out. Running is sort of an outward practice. Meditation, you sit with your eyes closed, it's an inner practice. You can meditate in a train and on the plane, wherever, even places where you can't be running. So now, it isn't for the physical activity, it's strictly a mental technique. But besides clearing the mind and helping you be more relaxed during the day, and there's a lot of studies on this, it's not just purely subjective, a lot of scientific research and lowering blood pressure and all, the effects carry over so that you find more clarity during the day. And it helps improve intuition. There are a lot of times, maybe that time of, you know, I bet runners would buy these photos, that intuition, you know, these things come, I think, more than they did before I learned to meditate. If for no other reason, and I don't know all the mechanics, but, you know, you have a little clearer mind, you're more settled, and you can sort of listen to what's going on inside that, you know, maybe you should try this. Maybe I should. And you get more attuned with nature and what's going on around you. It does help improve personal relations, I think.
I'm sure.
You just tend to be a happier person, which makes your social life better, family life better. So it does inform business in indirect but very profound ways, I think. And you mentioned the pictures of the Taj Mahal and the one of the birds flying in the foreground. And this will, that is one of my more pivotal images, believe it or not.
Oh, interesting.
And I will tell you why. And this was, I had been with my wife. We had been in India for a couple of weeks. And a friend of mine asked when we were leaving, and I told him, and he said, "Boy, are you in luck?" He was also a photographer. He said, "You're going to be going." We were in Varanasi, and we were going to be taking the train back to Delhi. And he said, "Well, you'll go through Agra." He said, "You can get off the train and photograph the Taj Mahal." I said, "I didn't even think of that. I, you know, wasn't planning on that." And he says, "No, and you know what's even better? It's going to be full moon."
Ah.
Now, I had seen a picture when I was in college of the full moon in the Taj Mahal, and I thought, I want that picture. Now, if you, after meditating for a while, you tend to, you sort of get to a place where you can sort of take life a little more easily and accept what comes at you more evenly, more equanimity in life. And to a very real way, that's what I experienced when I was in Boston when those bombs went off. There was a lot more calmness in equanimity that I had instead of, you know, flipping out on the whole thing.
Right,
which,
right,
you know, would make sense that for most people. But anyway, I had in mind that picture. I wanted that picture. Now, I got, we had made arrangements for a driver to take us to the Taj before sunrise, because if you get to a place on the day after the full moon, at sunrise the next morning, the moon will be going down because it came up, you know, full, now it's going down full. And I figured, I'm going to get the full moon if I'm at the east, looking west, I'm going to get the full moon with the Taj. That's right. My picture.
Right, sun behind,
and
right.
He takes us across the river. I've never been to Agra before. Don't know what's going on, but I sense that we're not going the right way. And he drops us off at this riverbank, and the Taj is way over there. And I start, I mean, sorry, but...
equanimity went out the window, yeah.
Well, it didn't completely go out the window, David, but it too much of it did. My American type A personality kicked in at this point. And I said, why are we here? We are supposed to be over there. I want the full moon. He says, oh, sorry, sir, you can't be there. And I said, why can't I be? He said, it's the holy day of the Muslims and it's closed. You can't get into the Taj today. But if you want to see the Taj, you have to be here. And so, okay, we're here. And he says, but maybe I can call you a boat and maybe he can take you across the river to the other side. He said, it's very early, but I will call you a boat. So I calmed down, the equanimity returned. And as we're waiting for a boatman to show up, I noticed that there was this bank of fog rolling in down the river.
Amazing.
And pretty soon my wife and I are encased in fog. And I thought, well, there goes pictures of the Taj. You know, we're not seeing anything now. It was totally, totally gone. And, but I thought, okay, whatever. This is what nature's doing today. You got to go with the flow. So then we heard lapping. And sure enough, a boatman had heard this guy's call, the driver's call. And we sort of, it was so thick with fog, we could barely see the guy. And then we sort of see this form. We walked over and that was the edge of the river. And he spoke enough English that he knew we wanted to go over and we went across. And as we get across to the other side, the fog was just starting to clear and the pigeons flew up. And that was the picture that I got. And I thought, you know, that was instructive because I had envisioned one thing. But I then had to learn to accept that something even better was going to come. And that was the even better picture.
I love it. All right. Well, I want to wrap up on one question that the legend has it that your father once said to you, photography is at the bottom of the list for making money when he was giving you some career advice. First of all, is that quote accurate? And second of all, how do you reflect on that 50 years after launching your photography career?
Oh, I reflected on a lot before that. He eventually was very proud that I had been able to make a career of it in spite of it all. And he was in a position to, because he was as I said, he was at the high school and at the end of his career, he was the college consultant. It was a large school, and he would advise people on what colleges to choose. And part of that was knowing what careers that students were interested in going into. You know, this would be a good school for that, and that would be for that. And when I mentioned to him, you know, he knew I was planning to probably become a teacher, but I had this new camera and I said, you know, I bet I could make a career out of this, you know, just sort of, and he said, Jim, Of the 10 least likely professions to make a living, photography is one of the at the bottom of the 10. And I says, yeah, but I think I can do it. He said, stick with education. But I'd already started this side business while I was finishing my master's thesis, and never went back to it, never had to. But he was glad that it had worked out.
Oh, I'm sure.
Hey, and I'm glad too. And I hope the runners are glad that it did. It's been a real, real honor to capture. I figure over 3 million runners that I've photographed at this point.
I'm sure. No, I don't think people fully appreciate what goes into that. And so that's why we thought it'd be so interesting to get a behind the scenes account of how that operation comes together and how you came up with this idea originally. And look, for every person who complains that race photos are too expensive, there are another 99 people who are really thrilled to get these photos and memorialize a nice moment in their life. And as you know, even if people don't buy their photos, they everyone enjoys looking at them, right? So as you know from seeing probably millions of photos watermarked across the internet saying "do not copy" that people have screenshotted and shared on Instagram over the years, it's nice to have spent your career in a profession where you're putting smiles on people's faces.
Yeah, thank you. There was one guy. This was getting the Marine Corps Marathon a few years ago. And, you always wonder, do people really, you said people see the pictures. Do you wonder, does it really make a difference in their lives or not? And this family had been, there was a press conference and they wanted me to photograph the press conference. And they were running together, and that's why they were at the press conference. And I went up to the father and I introduced myself, and he says, "Your marathon photo." And I said, "Yeah." And he pulled out his wallet. And he opened up a picture, one of the little ones. This was when, it was the little passport size one. And it was him with two little girls, one on either hand, at the finish line of the Marine Corps Marathon. And it was the same side that I had photographed from. So, it wasn't just a marathon photo, but it was one that I had actually taken. And he said, "I have carried this photo in my wallet every day since I got it, until the day when I could run with my two daughters across the finish line at the Marine Corps Marathon, and that was going to be the next day." So
that
made
cool.
It all worthwhile.
That is so cool. All right. Well, great note to end it on. Jim, you're so generous with your time. We'll book sessions 2 and 3 soon enough to get the rest of the stories. But I can't thank you enough for sharing this. This is great, insightful stuff.
Thank you very much, David.
We'll talk soon, I hope.
I hope so.